Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Justin Savakis, and welcome to AnCast. Zach is not joining us for this segment, but with me is my boss and our CEO, Chris McDonald.
Hey, how's it going?
So, we've kind of had a rough week.
Yeah, it's been a very rough week. Last week, I got an innocuous little email from Arcolo saying that due to a problem with one of their bandwidth providers, they would be doing some maintenance, and they told us about an 8-hour maintenance window, at the end of which we would notice some new uplink providers. Maintenance window came and went, and actually absolutely nothing happened. So it's, at first I was pretty happy, no downtime.
And then downtime, lots of downtime.
Yeah, then about 30 minutes after the end of the 30 or 45 minutes after the end of the prescribed maintenance window, everything went down. At first, I wasn't that worried. I was a little frustrated because the timing at this point was bad, and it was outside of the window we had been told about. But I wasn't that worried.
Now, I started freaking out a little bit once it became clear we couldn't contact anybody. Like, that was... I'd never experienced customer service that bad, especially on a B2B level.
Yeah, that was really bad. We still don't have the full details of what really went down. What we learned was that they were moving our servers to a different data center, which that alone is pretty egregious, in my opinion, because the email they sent us didn't say anything about touching our servers physically. It didn't say anything about movement. It just said that there'd be some downtime. And in other words, they went out of their way to imply one thing without stating it when they were in fact doing something completely different. It's kind of like having your landlord tell you that due to an electricity problem, they're going to make some changes so that you will now be getting your electricity from another provider. And then you come home one day and you can't get into your house. And all of your property has been moved to another house down the street that's serviced by a different electricity company. I'm not happy with the situation at all. But where it got really bad, what really, really, really frustrated us was that the downtime just kept going and going and going. We were originally told about an eight hour window, but the downtime, it went way over 8 hours, and we were at the 16-hour mark or so when we'd been calling them constantly, trying to get people to return our calls. I just wanted to know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, nobody was returning our calls. Nobody was. We couldn't get through past the customer service people who clearly didn't know anything.
Well, we weren't actually reaching customer service people. What we were reaching was a reception service. It was a different company whose job was to take calls and then forward them when customer service or technical reps were available. And the big problem really was that we weren't hearing anything back. I knew that the servers were down. I knew via a third party that they'd been moved to a different data center. But what I didn't know was where they were, what kind of progress they were making. At one point, some of the other servers hosted at the same colo facility had come online, servers belonging to other people, other websites. And ours still weren't. So that started making me worry that, well, maybe they think the job's done and they screwed something up with our servers and they're not even aware of it. So that's why it started becoming very urgent in my mind to contact them, and very frustrating that no one was returning the calls. And that's why I eventually decided to hop on a plane and return to North America.
You were in Japan at this point, we neglected to mention.
Yeah, I'd just been in Japan for a four-day business trip, and Friday, the day I left Japan, was actually supposed to be the first day of my brief vacation in Japan. It was Obon, one of the biggest holidays on the Japanese calendar. I'd never been in Japan for Obon before, and I decided to take advantage of it by going down to Kyoto and seeing all the cool stuff that goes on. But instead of going to Kyoto, I ended up on a flight to North America, first to Toronto and then to Texas. And what was going to happen when I got to Toronto, I was going to call other ANN staff and find out what the progress was. Now, the good news, I guess you could say, is that when I got to Toronto, I learned that most of our servers were back up. The network connection was reliable, it was steady, we were routing traffic back to our servers. The problem was that of four web servers, only two were online at that point. Essentially, we were out 50% of our web serving capability. The site was really slow. That was Friday. So instead of going to Texas, I went straight home. I figured network problems are done. So essentially, we figured at this point we could solve it without any drastic measures, and I could go home and solve it from there. And that's it. That's pretty much what happened. On Saturday, I talked to their network people. We got most of our remaining servers up and running. Pretty much everything is up and running now, except for one server, and unfortunately, it's one of our major web servers. So the site's running, but it's still slow. Right now, they are working on that web server, but they were working on, again, the communication isn't that great. I'm very frustrated with this company, and we'll see what happens. We might end up moving to another facility in the near future. A plan to move this time, but that's what happened. The company we host our servers with had some internal issues, and they decided to up and move our servers to a different location without telling us, and they ended up doing a very shoddy job of it. Not everything was turned on properly, and instead of taking 8 hours or less, it ended up taking somewhere around, I think, 36 hours.
Which is for a company our size that is entirely dependent. I mean, our whole company is a website. That's a fucking panic attack.
2 days of understood downtime is a panic attack. It is not a panic attack, but it's really, 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 really bad for us. 2 days of not knowing what the hell's going on. I mean, a day and a half into this, I still didn't know if we were going to be up soon, or if we were going to, or if this was going to drag on for several more days, which was why I was going straight to Texas initially.
I mean, just the panic of not even knowing for sure where the servers are.
I knew where they were. Like I said, third-party sources had told me what was going on, that they were being moved. I'm still not 100% clear on all the aspects of why. Yeah, I knew where they were. I mean, I in fact have I was given the address to where they were moved. And one of the frustrating parts is that they're actually in a data center that our old colo moved out of about a year and a half ago because it was unreliable. So
great.
Yeah. Now, possibly that data center's fixed all its reliability issues. I don't know. So there's a lot that we have to determine in the near future. And one thing that we definitely want to get in place is some sort of redundancy at a completely different facility under a different company's control. So even if we stay with this company, we still want to have a server at a different facility that can take over in case of downtime. Now, I'm not looking at complete redundancy. I'm not looking at setting up another seven servers at a different location, but I'm looking at some sort of Anime News Network limited edition. Actually, limited edition sounds wrong. Mini edition that would carry the news and some of the site features during extended downtime.
Right. So, like, what would be missing from that?
That's still completely to be determined. We might just turn off certain of the features that cause load, or we might turn off entire sections, like turn off the encyclopedia or turn off the forums. It's to be determined.
Well, that was a week. Yeah, let's never do this again.
Yeah, let's not.
Anyway, the good news is we're back up and running, if a little bit gimpy at the moment. So do you have a time frame yet for when we'll be back at full speed?
I want to say tomorrow. I really do. But it's really a matter of seeing what the problem with that server is. Like, we've identified that there's some sort of hardware problem with that server, so they may have damaged it in moving it. I'd say at the latest by midday Monday, but I'm really hoping to have it up and running by the weekend.
Well, that'd be pretty cool. All right. So thanks for joining us, and thanks for the update. And, you know, hopefully everything will be back to normal. And if we do have to take down the site again to move the servers again, we'll give some warning this time, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. If we have to take down if we have a scheduled move, we would actually probably do it in a way where limited services continued during the move. So that people could still visit the website. Something very similar to what I was talking about before with the redundant server.
Got it. Well, you have a full plate, and so I guess we'll find out more as things progress. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Just next time, let's make it about anime and not broken servers.
Yeah, that'd be nice, huh?
Okay, we're back. My guests this week are Deb Aoki from MangaDadabout.com. Hey, Deb.
Hey, how's it?
And Ed Sizemore from the Manga Out Loud podcast and MangaWorthReading.com. Hey, Ed.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Sure, you scarcely need any introduction. This is our third Super Manga Pals episode. I'm happy to have you guys back.
Thank you.
So let's just right out of the gate get started. Ed, let's start with you. What have you been reading lately? What would you recommend? Anything good?
I just read the new volume of 20th Century Boys, volume 16. I still love the series. That volume was really good, but it was also disappointing. I'm not going to spoil anything, but at the end of volume 15, there's a huge bombshell dropped. And then volume 16, Urasawa just says, I'm not going to deal with that right now. I'll leave that for future volumes. Right now, let's go into a flashback. And I'm like, oh, you're killing me, man. So everything I wanted this volume to be, it wasn't. So hopefully the next volume will finally do that. I also read, I caught up on Bakuman, which is really interesting. I like a lot of the industry stuff in it. Unfortunately, I think they gloss over some of the more important details. Like, it's a little one-page spread that essentially tells people you can't make a living as a beginning manga creator. Mm. The cost of your assistants, your studio rent, your utilities are all going to be greater than the salary that Shonen Jump is paying you. And so if your Tankobon doesn't sell, then you are just going to learn to live in debt. And I'm like, that should be a little bit more highlighted, I think. But it's also Shonen Jump, and they're not going to douse the fire too much. So, and otherwise I'm reading Cross Game, which is wonderful. Volume 4 just came out. Deb, actually, I'm interested to see if you have looked at this yet. It's Tankotaro.
Yes, I was going to talk about that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm still halfway through it, and that's really interesting. It's a pre-World War II manga, and according to the notes that are in it, one of the two kind of really big popular characters before the World War. So,
right.
Yeah, really interesting to see that.
Right. Yeah. That's a really rare example. I think that's probably the first pre-war manga that's been published in English. It's about a roly-poly robot who, it's kind of primitive. The artwork is, I mean, it's from the 1930s, 1940s. It's kind of strange because the artist does a lot of very surreal things with it. Like he battles enemies with like a chain of octopuses or something like that. He's very inventive, very carefree. But he also does things like, it's very clearly war propaganda It's very clearly a story that's meant to instill in the youth of Japan that it's awfully cool to go to war. And that's a little disturbing. but it predates Astro Boy. So, like, you know, you can imagine at a time when Japan was just, you know, just past the Meiji era. It's like, it's kind of sci-fi. It's like this robot. He can do anything. He looks a little bit like a samurai with a top knot. But he can do all kinds of amazing and surreal things. It was kind of odd because I read it maybe a few days after I had read Onward Towards Our Noble Death by Shigeru Mizuki, which was very much a tale that was told several years after the war. I mean, in the 1960s, Shigeru Mizuki actually went to war and lost his arm being in the war. He is the creator of Gegege no Kitaro. And his story is much more bitter, much more about kind of catch-22 for Japan, like how stupid it is that his commanding officers want to sacrifice all these soldiers' lives to win a war, to win a battle that means nothing. So you've got, when I read both Tankuro and Onward Towards Our Noble Death, like kind of like a bookend, it was kind of it's an interesting contrast, I gotta say.
So this is one of those things where as a museum piece, it's more interesting as a museum piece than it is actually like something you're gonna get into.
Yeah, it's more something that you look at as, okay, this is what manga came from.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you mostly love the current manga and like that, you're going to be kind of like, what the heck is this, you know? It's kind of simplistic, it's kind of strange, it doesn't make much sense. In some cases, you're a little disturbed by the overt propaganda of it all.
Yeah.
You know, amidst its childlike nature. But what's interesting about this book is, one, it's beautifully presented. The cover art is by Chris Ware, who did Acme Novelty Library. It's in a beautiful slipcover, and it has a wonderful essay that's written by the creator's son, and he explains his father's life. I mean, the artist went on to become a Zen priest in his later life. So it's a fascinating document. I mean, this is something that you wouldn't necessarily buy to say, oh, you know, wow, I finished reading Gekkaishi, so I want to read something that's going to be purely entertaining. This is something you read because it's like it gives you context for Japan's history and manga heritage. So it's not for everybody, but if you're interested in manga and manga history and how manga has shaped Japanese history, I think it's an interesting read.
Yeah. The other people I think who are really going to enjoy this are the comic strip historians, people who like go back and read the old Mutt and Jeffs and the Crazy Cats.
Because
reading this, it reminds me a lot of some of that early experimentation that you see in the old newspaper strips, contemporary to that, like in the 20s and the 30s when the newspaper comic strips were a much more open format and there was a lot of like playing around with form and genre. So I think
also,
people like that.
Readers were much more innocent at the time, you know? Don't you think? I mean, there wasn't like this demand for this continuity, you know? and that it had to make sense in the sense like physics makes sense and science makes sense and gravity makes sense, you know?
Right. No, and I think that's excellent because one of the things I noticed that this does that a lot of like the early cartoons, Betty Boop or Mickey Mouse or even some of the early Warner Brothers does, is it either explains the visual joke or it repeats a visual joke. Yeah. Like you get a sense that people aren't used to the visual medium yet. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to catch that like 1 second joke. Mm-hmm. And so they tend to point them out to them to say, this is funny because they're educating their audience in a sense.
It's a little literal.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, so later, the stuff that he's doing, you know, like when you read Tezuka, he's not going to have to point out the visual joke. People will get it because they know how to read that stuff now.
Right.
But it's interesting to see some of this, the early experimenters with form having to kind of, you know, walk their audience through what they're doing.
Right. I think, you know, you have to read it understanding that this comes from a different time and place and before it's the roots of manga. And if you try to measure it under, it's basically like trying to say, oh my God, it's, you know, the horse and carriage, man. It's just not as fast as a Tesserosa. You know what I mean? It's that's not right. But you appreciate that at a certain point in that history, this was the only way to go.
Yeah, it's like these Yellow Kid cartoons are nowhere near as funny as Kate Beaton, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah,
no. Exactly. Why are you comparing those two? Yeah.
So I appreciate that, you know, that Press Pop and Last Gas have put this out, but it is not for everybody.
Well, it's cool. Right. Something like that. I'm glad that something like that even got released because, you know, we don't get a lot of that history stuff here. And that I guarantee you there's going to be at least a half dozen, like every manga book from now on will include mention of that. I guarantee you. Guarantee you. But anything else? Or just anything else, Deb?
I've been reading a lot of trash.
All right.
Tenjo Tenge.
Yep. Fun trash. I like Tenjo Tenge is great.
Yeah. But for some odd reason, because Digital Manga just put out their first release on their Digital Manga Guild, so I read Tired of Waiting for Love.
How did it turn out?
It's not bad. It's to my eyes and ears, it was basically indistinguishable from most other digital manga re-releases, you know, translation-wise, you know, graphic design-wise. But it was weird because then I went into the e-manga site a little deeper and I picked up Men of Tattoos and Rabbit Man, Tiger Man, which are both also Yakuza stories. And I consider like Tired of Waiting for Love is the baseline, standard, everyday, you know, Japanese gangsters who suddenly like to like get it on with each other, you know, like to get a taste for doing up the back end because they did it in jail. You know, okay. I'm just saying it's a huge fantasy. It's stupid. But, you know, it's like, it's kind of like a Cinderella story. The damaged young man meets this stoic gangster who kind of like shows him what love really means. Blah, 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 blah. You know, take away the tattoos, take away the guns, take away the drug deals. It's basically a Harlequin novel. But then I read Men of Tattoos, and Men of Tattoos is also Yakuza's story, but it turns a trope completely upside down. Like, when you whatever you think the story is going to go to, that she puts in a lot of twists. There's a lot of interesting things that go on, like you think, oh, that's what's happening. And then two stories later, it's like, oh, whoa, that was a dream sequence. What? And then there's this other short story where there's these two guys in college and one has a crush on the other. And he has this, his object of his affection comes to him as a, like an ectoplasm ghost and has sex with him.
Right.
And then, yeah, it's kind of, it's strange. And then the other guy says, I had a dream last night too. He goes, oh no, really? And he says, look, you know, look at my hand. This is where you put your cock through it.
Oh,
what?
My God. Huh.
It's crazy. It is hella crazy. So pick up Men of Tattoos. If you've ever read Boys Love and thought, oh yeah, same old, same old. Pick up this one and you're going to go, what the hell is going on here?
Also, if you're really into ghost fucking, there you go.
Oh, hell yeah. So, I mean, I was kind of raving about it because it just completely blew my mind. I'm not a big boys love person, and I don't think Yakuza manga is particularly hot, but this one kind of blew my mind.
Wow. Interesting. Well, at least they're putting out, you know, unique stuff.
Yeah, no, I props to them, man. I mean, I don't know why, but for some reason, trash has been, like, I read Aiore. You know that one, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we published a review by our relatively new manga critic, who really kind of, I was kind of surprised because she's describing the story and she was sort of like, yeah, it's not really that big a deal. But the story she's describing, it's like, wait, how much of this is rape based? Like, this seems like it's a big deal. What?
But, you know, I read volume two and volume two kind of, at the end of volume one, it goes into this creepy, you know, like rape scene, like where the male protagonist tries to protect the female protagonist's honor by getting the female bully who's bullying his girlfriend get her raped. Okay, creepy, right? And then like Mayu Shinjo, you go to volume two and she kind of like, okay, she's went to the edge of the precipice of good taste and she veers back into kooky sex gender comedy. Go figure.
Huh. Well,
but it's a, you know, like if you've read Sensual Phrase, who's also by the same author, yeah, it kind of flirts on the edge of creepy.
I saw most of the anime for Sensual Phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much my reaction to it. The girl I was dating at the time was really into it, and so there you go. The only manga that I have read lately was in their giveaway freebie bags at Comic-Con. Viz was giving out the first volume of Bakuman.
Oh, yeah.
And, Ed, you were just talking about this, but I saw the first episode of the anime and the really dumb I'm going to marry you when you put me in an anime or manga thing or whatever. Just kind of blew my mind, and I was like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. And then, so I got the manga, and I was like, all right, whatever, you know, bored on a Sunday or something. And not much better, I gotta say. It's, the premise is so dumb that it's just hard for me to care. But I do really like, I find all the, you know, insight into the manga industry, however accurate it may or may not be. That stuff is really interesting. I just wish it didn't have the dumb girl thing in it.
It's I agree. So but it does get better. I mean, it does that part of the plot goes into the background.
Okay. There's,
you know, I mean, so as you read to volume 3, volume 4, volume 5, granted, it's still a completely unrealistic view of how manga is, you know, how a high school kid becomes a manga creator. But it's still fascinating. I mean, when I met, did you meet, Sasaki-san, who's the editor of Shonen Jump?
No.
Comic-Con?
Nope.
He's a former editor-in-chief of Shonen Jump. He was at the J-Manga panel and reception later on. Mm. He did a Shonen Jump panel where he critiqued storyboards.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I read your write-up on that.
And it was really funny because, you know, there's a character in Bakuman who's kind of him. And then you see him in person and he goes, yeah, I must apologize. I don't look as cool as how, you know, Obata-sensei draws me. Right. Because everyone is always disappointed when they meet me because I don't look as cool. But, I think he's an utterly fascinating person. And I think it's great that Bakuman gives people this insight into this world.
Yeah, it's I mean, if I got a bunch more of it for free, yes, I would probably sit there and read it, but... I can't imagine running down to the store. Well, I guess I can't do that anymore, but but the other thing I wanted to briefly mention, I'm not in the first segment this week, and we were going to talk about this, but something came up. But have either of you seen Redline?
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, as soon as you possibly humanly can legally watch it. I imported the Blu-ray sight unseen because it was expensive, and that's a tax write-off. So, okay, fine. You know, hey, everyone tells me this movie kicks ass. I think it actually put its foot all the way through my ass because I was blown away by how absolutely incredibly top-notch A-plus it was.
Wow.
Like, I loved it. If Evangelion 2.22 had not come out this year, I could say unqualified, like, this is the best anime movie, maybe the best anime I've seen in a very long time.
Really?
I think it's almost revolutionary in how freaking good it is. Like, I just love it. I don't want to go on and on because it's anime and this is supposed to be a manga show.
But, no, it sounds great. I've been wanting to, like, it played at New People, so I was dying to see it, but it's sold out.
Yeah, I can, yeah, that it as well it should. Like, yeah, it's just so freaking good.
Well, there were like a dozen people on Twitter all imported it like you did.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because the hype for that movie has been pretty high, and everybody said the same thing. It's like it totally lives up to the hype. It's actually better than you, even with all the hype. It ends up being a better movie than you think it'll be, and so I was like, ugh, they really got to get that over here soon. So.
I think what feels so crazy about it is that it's a relatively sort of somewhat complicated but easy to understand science fiction premise that's original, makes sense in the narrative, doesn't shit the bed, doesn't get weird or incomprehensible or stupid or whatever. It stays really good the whole way through. There's characters you care about. The sci-fi is really neat. It's a really fun and cool concept, which basically boils down to there's this racing organization that is illegal, and they have star racers, and it floats around in this big spaceship, and they basically drop the race onto a planet. This whole community comes out, you know, they build this slum for bettors and racers and stuff, and this time they drop it on a planet that this military society is using exclusively for unauthorized experimental military technology demonstrations.
What?
So they basically they're having an illegal street race through crazy fucking weapon systems.
Wow.
And that's a really cool sci-fi premise, and they pull it off 100%. It is perfect. I loved it.
Wow.
But anyway.
No, I definitely want to check it out. I mean, I haven't seen Summer Wars yet, and I hear such wonderful things about Summer Wars, too.
Yeah, Summer Wars is good. It's no Red Line, but it's good.
Okay.
So the big news this week that we should get to is the big launch of jmanga.com, which is the latest very ambitious attempt by the Japanese publishing industry to get some money or traction legally in the English-speaking world. And I know, obviously, it's only been up for a day, and we haven't had too much time to process the whole thing yet, but I'm curious what your reviews of the site are right now, how you feel about what you've seen already. And I guess let's start with Ed.
So far, I like what I saw. I mean, it's got some glitches, and I'm writing up a piece for MangaWorthReading.com, but my thoughts are, for something fresh out of the gate, I'm not expecting it to be perfect. So, you know, some people have complained that the translations are a little rough. There's some features with the viewer that I'm not completely happy with, although it's a minor glitch that I... when I'm looking at the selection, there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been available in English before, and it's... covers a fairly expansive genre of material, so I'm kind of excited. I'm kind of hoping it lives up to its promise.
What do you think of the, just out of curiosity, how do you feel about the way the manga is presented?
I actually like the viewer. One of the things that the viewer has that I really like is it's got three modes. You can either do two pages, one page, or panel by panel. And the one thing that particularly sold me is, I mean, besides the fact it's nice and high resolution, is that if you're in the one page or the panel by panel mode and the panel you go to is a splash panel that goes over two pages, it'll automatically show you the whole panel. And then when you click next, it'll go back to either the one panel or the one page or the panel by panel view. So you're not getting that little weird thing where you only see like a third of a panel or something. You'll get to see the whole visual image and then go back and look at the details a little bit more. So it's actually well designed. I mean, I wish it wasn't flash based so I could see it on my iPad, but other than that, that's just a minor complaint, and I figure they'll deal with that at some point.
Well, they need an app, right?
Yeah, they do. I mean, it would be nice if they did an e-reader app, you know, across the platforms, Android, Apple, all those, because I think it would be a better viewing experience since it is set up for a computer screen right now.
So, I think that's something that they're working on, because when I spoke with them, they said the main hang-up was Apple had recently changed their billing system for in billing from within an app.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, so that put a real monkey wrench in their plans to release an iPod app. I think they're still trying to work that out. But iOS is definitely first on their priority as the next step. And then Android is after that. And then after that, e-readers such as Kindle and Nook and so on.
Well,
so it's not like this has never occurred to them to have it on an iPad or iPod. There are other factors out that influence this.
The reality is, in this day and age, if you want to digitally publish and you're not on Apple, you're not going to make any money. Like,
yes.
Period. Like, that's
right.
I've been hearing people talk about how, like, a lot of developers now are saying, well, we're not going to develop for Android because you have to reach a certain number of people in order to make any money on these 99-cent little apps. And so people are, like, not really – it's not like they're not developing for Android, but a lot of publishers are like, look, unless we can guarantee a certain number, tens of thousands of people buying this application – we're just going to stick to Apple because the install base is so massive. So I'm surprised that they didn't make sure, but like before launching, they had the app out. But whatever, I'm sure they'll get it.
They said that the billing policy changed in June.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So they had to. Like, and I spoke with them in July. So I think they were a little floored. I think they were a little thrown off base by that.
Yeah, you don't want to delay your launch by too much. So
yeah. I mean, obviously at Comic-Con, you know, Viz announced their Viz Manga app, vizmanga.com portal, website, yeah, with the iPad and iPod, and they were all set. So, you know, obviously they were willing to do this, and they were, you know, prepared. But, you know, Viz is based in San Francisco, and Viz has been dealing with digital publishing for a while now. So I think they were much more comfortable with it. I can't really speak for them, but it was interesting timing. You know, the Comic-Con announcement of Viz Manga at the same time when, you know, J Manga is making their big play. Yen Press is showing off their iPhone app. Square Enix is reminding everyone that they do sell manga online.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's the worst too.
So Dark Horse is telling us that they're developing a manga specific app that can read, you know, in the manga style. So everyone is getting on board with this. It's not like, you know, manga publishers are going like, oh, this iPad thing, what is that?
Yeah.
Well, and I would imagine, because the feeling I get is this is like a loose confederation of the 39 publishers. Mm. And so everything is publisher driven. So like when Apple changed their billing policy, they had to go back and talk to like each of those 39 people and get them all to come on board to the new billing policy. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that's just a nightmare, dealing with 39 Japanese companies about changes in the billing structure. So,
I completely understand what J Manga is doing is incredibly ambitious and difficult. I mean, like I was pointing out on Twitter, it's like, okay, DC, Dark Horse, Marvel are all using completely separate platforms,
yeah,
billing structures, and different pricing structures. So the fact that the big three can't even agree,
yeah,
in US, I mean, come on, give the Japanese a break.
How do you feel about the pricing structure?
It's ill-informed.
You think so? You think it's bad? Well, could you just describe exactly what it is so people know?
It's on a point system. So in a U.S. dollar sense, it's a penny a point.
Oh.
So like if something is 899 points, it's $8.99. People ask why the point system. Well, it's partly because the ambition for J Manga is to be an international service. Mm. So rather than having each title say, okay, this is $8.99, this is $9.50 for Canada, this is 259 baht, this is 260 Hong Kong dollars, whatever the conversion is, it's just one number. So this makes sense in that sense. However, it seems odd in the sense of like, why don't you just say $8.99?
Well, let me ask you this, because this is another thing that happens with other similar point-based systems. Do you have to buy set amounts of points?
Yes.
Okay, so you got to buy...
It's like Xbox 360. We have to buy
okay.
That's so it's like Carnival Script, really.
It's a good way to make extra money, because I can't just buy the manga I want. I have to give you $10 for an $8 manga, and then... have to buy another $10 when I want to buy something that's 15. Like, it's the point system's kind of drive me crazy.
There's a lot of things about it that have bothered people right off the gate. I mean, when we were at Comic-Con, and people asked, someone in the audience says, how much is this going to, what's the pricing? How much is it going to cost? Oh, it was priceless, because all the publishers all looked at each other like, you answer that. No, you answer that. Ooh, I don't know, you answer that.
Well, it's based on what the publisher wants to charge, right?
Exactly. I mean, I think that was, you know, like how in politics there are these ugly compromises.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And for J Manga, it seemed completely obvious that no one could agree on what to charge for a volume of manga. So they all looked at each other and go, you know what? You guys can all decide for yourselves how much you all want to charge, and you can all charge different amounts for different amounts of content. Okay? Shut up. Let's go.
Yeah.
Well, and you see that in the previews too, because some publishers are giving you like a 5-page preview. And then some publishers are giving you the entire first chapter as a preview. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it gives the site a little bit of a schizophrenic feel in that sense. I mean, I get it, because I understand that it's a publisher-by-publisher decision. Mm-hmm. And so you just you start looking at who the publishers are, and you know what the content's going to be, and you know what they're going to give you and what they're not. But I would imagine for people who are newer to manga and newer to the whole Japanese system of business, this is going to seem a little strange. Like, you know, why when I click on this preview do I get 5 pages, but when I click on this one I get, you know, 30 pages, yeah, like the whole first chapter.
Figured it out. I mean, if you've dealt with Japanese publishers before, as far as getting permission to use interior pages, as you know, when I write reviews, it's impossible. You know, when I deal with publishers, they will let me publish usually just the cover. I'm not allowed to use interior panels.
Yeah, nope.
Mm-hmm. Not used to use interior pages without very, very specific and express permission from the artist and from the publisher to do so.
Yeah.
So this is because they were very paranoid about piracy.
And with good cause.
Yes, yes. But they overreacted.
Yeah.
So, you know, like in people, reviewers in the U.S., we're used to fair use clauses, right? Where you can grab a couple pages just for the review, and just because you're using it to illustrate a point you're making about that particular book. It's not the entire book. It's a panel. It's a page, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, when I worked at Anime Insider, the big thing back then was to have manga previews. Mm-hmm. So we would run 15 pages of a manga, new manga, before the book actually came out. The number of flaming hoops that we had to jump through to get that approved, I swear to God, it went through like 7 layers of bureaucracy before they said, okay, you can print it like this. But literally down to the like, okay, this needs to be moved over 0.5 centimeter. You know, literally, really ridiculous.
It's excruciating. Like anyone who has dealt with Japanese publishers, getting approvals from Japanese publishers, know that it can be an excruciating, nitpicky process that just causes immense delays.
Yeah.
So there's a certain point where I can just almost imagine them being in a room, kind of like John Boehner and John, you know, President Obama, going, "You know what? Fuck it. Just do it already, kid. I want to go home.
Yeah.
I want to see my wife again. Just shut up. You can have it. Mm-hmm. Go away."
So, do you think it's going to succeed? I mean, what do you think?
I think they have to address their pricing because it is on. It is too high.
So. Ed?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see the pricing drop a little bit. And the problem for me is, as a middle-aged man with a, you know, stable income, I can justify $8.99 for some pretty weird purchases.
Yeah, not that big a deal, yeah.
I mean, you know, like I'm willing to pay $9 to read the first volume of Anesthesiologist Hannah, just because I think it's such a crazy idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure, you know, $9 is a movie price. So, and that's, you know, for me, movies are disposable kind of entertainment, where 90% of the movies I see, I'm never going to read again. I'm never going to go watch them again. So if I pay $9.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I pay $9 and read, you know, a manga and it doesn't really move me, I'm not going to read it again, but it was a neat novelty experience, then I'm not feeling like I'm really losing out on that. But I would imagine for, you know, the majority of the manga base, since they're younger, a lot of them tend to be students, you know, $9 for a novelty isn't really going to work.
Well, especially since it's something you can't keep and own.
Right.
It's basically just the permission to read it online. Yeah. Admittedly, you can read it online into all perpetuity, but perpetuity means until J-Manga goes out of business.
Yeah, and also, if you don't have an internet connection, guess what? You can't read the manga.
You can't read it offline either. Right. So it's not like an MP3 file where, you know, you download it from iTunes and you can listen to it anywhere. It's like you have to be online to read it.
Yeah, I can see that being an issue for a lot of people. But, the fact of the matter is, like, Ed is probably the customer that they're really going for right now. Somebody who, for whom that price point is not a big deal, just wants to read it legally and wants it all in one place, and is okay with the decisions that they've made.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, the most people that you're going to hear talk about this are the sort of consumer for whom several of the things that I just said are absolutely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and the response to the launch of it was mostly a bunch of nitpicking and bitching.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in my opinion, I looked through it. I clicked through the first volume of One Piece, or whatever, the first chapter of it, whatever much they give you. And I actually thought the resolution was a little low, but that's an old volume, so I don't know.
Right.
I just didn't. Right. Maybe it depends on the series.
I think they just didn't do... I mean, I can imagine that there's a certain point where the publishers want... They want the artists to get paid. They want to get paid. And they want to make a return on investment on creating this website and this whole technological platform.
Yeah.
So they thought, oh, $8.99 is a perfectly fair price. And we've seen similar things like NTT Somare, which does also publishes online manga through like iPad and iPhone. Yeah. It's a Japanese company. And they charge very similar rates. The problem is you can't compare the pricing with another Japanese company. You have to compare it with what comparable U.S. companies are charging. So like Viz, Yen Press, Dark Horse, Comixology are all charging roughly half price or less of the print edition. So you've got, you know, I mean, admittedly, there is a contingent of fans who just want it free or just want it on a Netflix model, which is all I can eat for a flat rate for a given period of time. Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are people who will never be happy unless it's free or unless it's a flat rate model. But, you know, with the fact that the J-Manga system is at the high end, if not, you know, almost double of what other comparable digital comic sites are charging for the same amount of content.
Yeah.
Really doesn't work well. I mean, I don't know what the math was. I don't know what the decision making factors were behind them choosing that pricing structure. But I personally feel that they, and when I've met them and talked with the people from J-Manga and the publishers, they are very keen to hear what fans want to say. They are very keen to hear how the market plays out. So I feel fairly confident that if enough people say, you know what, this pricing doesn't work for me, you know what, I mean, or they vote with their wallets and don't buy it, I have a feeling they're going to sort things out. Things are going to sort themselves out.
Yeah, well, here's what the fans will tell you they want. Some bullshit, unreasonable Fantasyland business model that's like that's totally suicidal and would kill off any publisher really, really quick. That's what the fans want you to do. But, yeah, what? I mean, I have to say, like, I'm getting a little tired of the fact that this is an attempt. It's a fair attempt. They're making a real... effort here to launch something that they think is going to work. They've made a tremendous amount of material available. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay, so it's overpriced. I personally, deep down inside, am okay with them trying to revalue their product a little bit, mm-hmm. like drive the price up just a bit. Because telling everybody that 99 cents or nothing is not, you're going to kill off so much business that way.
I mean, people, I asked this in an interview, and I don't think they really answered this, but I would ask this to fans too. What do you want? Do you want it fast? Do you want it good? You know, or, you know, I mean, do you want high quality or do you want it fast or you want it cheap? You can't have them all.
Right. You got to pick one or two of those things, tops.
You can maybe get two, you know, but like it's like going to the Chinese restaurant. You can get two entrees and maybe some rice, but you're not going to get three entrees.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if they're not getting it, like, while the ink is still wet on the page, they're not going to be happy anyways.
No, and there's a contingent of people who never be happy unless it's free, fast, and cheap. No, free, fast, and high quality. All
in perfect, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to them I say, please, you go and draw manga. You translate manga. Yeah. You create a website. Go ahead. See how hard it is.
Yeah.
And one of the ironies here is, you know, people want those chapters as they come out in Japan, and one of the things you learn as you start reading like author's notes in the back of Tankobon is that a lot of times what gets published on a weekly basis is a little bit of a compromise. It's like, okay, I've got 7 days to produce 20 pages, and if anything goes wrong, if I get sick, if I'm stuck on a story point, I still have to do 20 pages, and sometimes that means that the art's not as well as I want it to be. The dialogue isn't as smooth as it wants to be, and so it's interesting to see how many of those authors go back and touch up artwork and dialogue, and sometimes even story points for the Tankobon release. And so a lot of times, the impression I get is the authors are like, you know, it's okay if you read the serialized version just because you want to like stay on top of it, but the version that you know we consider to be the best version is the collected version, because that's when we've had a chance to make sure it's exactly what we thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so a lot of times I want to say, you know, if they're going to change a little bit of the artwork, if they're going to clean it up, if they're going to add more detail, if they're going to smooth out some of the dialogue, you know, I'm okay with waiting for the better product. So, yeah, I did.
Well, like Shogakukan, for example, when they did Rinne, they basically started the translation process when at the point where Takahashi Sensei was doing storyboards.
Right.
So they saved some time that way. So, you know, obviously, like, if people want the releases on the same day that the print edition shows up in Japan, they want a translated version, there are adjustments that have to be made, but can be made. You know, like, for example, if in a dream scenario, you could see Weekly Shonen, every story in Weekly Shonen Jump in every language around the world online on the same day that that print edition shows up on any given Japanese train station books, you know, newsstand, how awesome would that be? That'd be great. But you know what? This is not, that's only worthwhile for the most extremely popular manga, because that's a lot of work.
Yeah, you have to make it make sense money-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah, and God bless Viz for doing Rinne like that, because, I mean, that is just such a commitment of money and time that I don't envy him for.
And Shogakukan, too. I mean, when I spoke to Tanaka-san from Shogakukan, they considered Rinne as the grand experiment. It's like, if we can make this work, you know, we want to try to do this more. But, you know, I asked him, is this scalable? And he couldn't answer.
Right. Yeah. Did he give any hints as to how Rinne did sales-wise?
Not really. I think we all agree that Rinne was made sense because it is Rumiko Takahashi, one of the most popular, most successful manga artists in the world. But would you do this for every manga release that comes out in every manga magazine in Japan? I don't think it's worth the effort.
Well, I ask that under the general belief that Rinne seemed to be a bit of a flop in terms of I never heard anyone talking about it ever.
No one
seems to care about it.
I will admit very, very, very unequivocally that it's not Rumiko Takahashi's best work.
Right.
It is not something that people are clamoring for like they clamor for the latest episode of One Piece.
Or in years past, Inuyasha.
Yeah. Inuyasha, yes. But, you know, and we could also argue, like, has doing this simultaneous release, simultaneous of the tankobon in Japanese and in English, simultaneous release of the weekly episodes in Japanese and in English, has that stopped piracy? Has that increased sales? Who's to say?
Yeah, well, you'd have to ask them. You'd certainly hasn't stopped piracy.
They won't tell you.
We know it hasn't stopped piracy. We can say that.
Well, I mean, as far as sales, I mean, in Japan and in America, Rinne, when the volume of Rinne gets released as a tankobon, it does generally break the top 10. Mm-hmm. But you'll notice that it only breaks the top 10 for that week, and then it disappears. So I get the feeling that it's pretty much like the hardcore Takahashi fans who are purchasing it. It's not a breakout into like the mainstream the way, let's say, One Piece or a Bleach or Naruto is.
Yeah, I would argue that the better experiment, and maybe someday Shueisha will jump in on this experiment, and they'll do this for One Piece.
Yeah,
maybe.
And that will be fascinating if they ever get the balls to do that.
Yeah. But speaking of e-readers, I just wanted to bring this up. I recently, like in the last couple of days, upgraded my iPod finally to a fourth generation and downloaded the Viz Media app. And Deb, you recently upgraded your phone, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I put the Viz Media app on it. And honest to God, you know, that Blackbird that they give you right away? I flipped through it, and it was perfectly readable, nice, high resolution. Like, the screen resolution, I feel, is finally high enough on that phone for me to be perfectly happy flipping through a manga. And for the first time, I was like, oh, I could read manga this way, because the resolution is
high. No, that's how I read I Already Volume 2, honestly. Mm. I bought it online, and I read it on the website, and I read it on my phone.
Right. And
it's perfectly acceptable.
Even so much as the last generation of iDevices, like my iPod 3G, the resolution wasn't high enough. You know, I mean, I could zoom in, but I don't want to have to zoom in. I want the whole page in front of me at once. And
the technology has caught up with manga.
Right. So now, and in the past, I was like, I can't really see myself reading manga on a device like that. Suddenly now I understand, oh, yes, I can. I could totally read a bunch of manga on this. That would be fine. And it actually seems like a pretty good platform to do it on, because it is disposable, like I said. You know, unless I really am in love with the series, like Berserk or something like that, I don't necessarily feel the need to have giant cluttered bookshelves
full
of disposable comics.
Iori Voluntary was perfectly acceptable to buy at $5.99.
Yeah.
It was easier to stomach than paying $10.99 for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a perfect, you know, and I was explaining to someone online, it's like, I like it for the quick disposable read that I just need to pick up and, you know, check out. And if I love it, I'll go buy the print edition, you know? Mm-hmm. Like Ooku, I'll always buy the print edition because I love that series and I'll read it over and over again. But Iori, which is, frankly, trashy fun, $5.99 is perfectly fine for me. And that's the problem with J-Manga's pricing structure, you know, is that it demands that you love it at $8.99 or $9.99 level.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's series that you're not sure if it's worth $8.99.
I wonder if they could institute some kind of a popularity thing or a ratings thing, where if it's a 4 or 5 star manga, you're going to pay $8. 2 stars, you're going to pay $5. That's almost brutally meritorious. It's almost a brutal meritocracy.
That's scary, isn't it?
But if the readers don't really like it, but they're buying it, you price it cheap. I don't know.
It's hard to say because, like, I mean, I've only like given a quick cursory look because obviously I had other things to do today, like, you know, like an actual job.
Your job, yeah.
So I couldn't really look through all of J-Manga's offerings, but there were several in there that were very high quality, wonderful works that I would love to, you know, read in print. I think it was like, what was that one about the dog? Do you remember that one, Ed?
Oh, the Stargazing Dog?
Stargazing Dog, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was
I have that in Japanese, and it's a beautiful story. Or the stories by Fumio Kono, who did Tanabe Nikom, Country Cherry Blossoms. She has two stories up, and they're also amazing and wonderful.
So, yeah, actually, that was my first purchase, was the to all the corners of the world.
Yes,
which is it's the book she wrote after Town of Evening Calm, Country of Cherry Blossom. She needs to cut those titles down. but it actually takes place before. I mean, they're not sequels or prequels or anything, but. Mm-hmm. It takes place during World War II as opposed to, like, the aftermath of World War II.
And it speaks of the effect that, you know, what wartime was like for everyday people.
Yeah, and it's really well written. It's that same kind of warm, gentle storytelling that the first volume had. So I really liked it. And the funny part was there's a great interview with her on the website also.
Right.
And the funny part is, these are the only two books that she's ever written that deal with World War II. And so she was saying, you know, yeah, I know in America everybody thinks of me as a war author, but I actually don't generally write about war. These were kind of two exceptions, and it just happens to be that 2/3 of what's available in English is my war stuff. Mm. You know, where, like, apparently prior to writing these kind of stories, she was generally writing for Coma. Manga. So,
four panel
manga. So I'd actually be interested in seeing some of her early stuff, because she said that a lot of her sensibility as a storyteller still comes from that. You know, having to end the sequence upbeat, and because they were talking about, like, all of her stories tend to have, like, a punchline or a little bit of a happy ending. So,
well, there's definitely a lot of a certain wistfulness, certain slice of life charm to her stories. I think what was interesting when I was talking with the J Manga publishers is, you know, I said, oh, you know, is this your opportunity to bring in genres that maybe would never have gotten a chance in the American market? Things like sports manga, things like manga that's longer than 10 volumes. And they were very very enthusiastic about that. You know, they said, yeah, you know, there's thousands of manga that never sees the light of day in America because we think, yeah, we know that it's too Japanese for you people. It requires too much appreciation or knowledge of Japanese culture. I mean, that's partly why some people don't think Saint Onisan, for example, the manga about Buddha and Jesus living as 20-something slackers in Tokyo, doesn't make sense to bring in English because so much of its humor relies upon you understanding what life is like in Tokyo and Japanese culture. And then you'll see, like, in what some of the super quirky titles that are in J-manga, like the manga about Ekiben or train station bentos.
Yes.
That is very quirky. Or the manga about the Iron Chef type gourmet competition takes place in a prison. That is super hella quirky. You know that no fan out there would going, oh my god, you have to bring this in English.
Yeah.
You know, because it's too Japanese, goddammit. But it's for a reader like me or like you or anyone who appreciates Japanese culture or just quirky comics, period, thinks, hallelujah.
Right.
Pass the bacon. You know, this is awesome.
That's right.
That's a good point.
I'm waiting for my pachinko manga.
Hell right. Yeah. Mahjong manga.
Oh, that too. Oh, yeah.
A lot of that. And the other good thing about it is it's also potential because it's coming straight from the publishers themselves. Mm-hmm. So you can get, I mean, their flag, the one that they're putting on their front page and advertising the most heavily is One Piece, which
right.
is already available here by this little company called Viz. But what this also means is that, like, say, like, an imprint of a major American comics publisher that decides to get into manga goes out of business. This means that you have a second chance at getting that. Like, you know,
there are at least one CMX title is actually on J-Manga now, and it is just the CMX digital files.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's got the CMX logo all over it.
Broccoli, Dew Press, Aurora. A lot, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a lot of Tokyopop, of course, yeah. The Kadokawa ties, the Tokyopop, yeah. Like Fate Stay Night and so on, Future Diaries. They're not all up right now, but the fact that they posted them and said they're going to publish them, to right. me, says, you know, and when I spoke with them, they were emphatic. Like, this was a void that they were hoping to fill.
Yeah, man, might remind me of Broccoli. Kind of miss them.
I know. They were great, weren't they?
Well, I didn't like any of their books, but they made... They were really nice people, and their books were so nice. Like, just right. in terms of the paper stock and the cover, and it's all glossy and nice. Yes, they put out really nice books. Not that I cared about Aquarian Age or whatever, but yeah.
I know, but they cared a lot about it, and they were super nice to deal with.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the highway's littered with the corpses of, you know, abandoned manga publishers.
At this point, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get to Twitter, because we got a lot of Twitter questions here.
All right.
First up, from Wayne01, what do you guys think of the omnibus editions of manga? I love them, but a lot of people I know seem to think they ruin something. I have never heard that argument before.
I've never heard that argument. How does it ruin it?
I don't know. Is it? Does it? Either you ever feel that way? Ever even hear of that?
No, in fact, I think most people, in fact, I'll tell you from Viz's panel at Otakon, people were actually upset. Viz's current policy is only to do the first 12 volumes of a series in omnibus. And part of that is because, you know, like something like Full Metal Alchemist, those other volumes are still in print and fairly available. I mean, Viz is not going to cut their own sales. So... it was interesting. People wanted to see like Full Metal Alchemist completely omnibused.
Well, they don't. That's not entirely true because, for example, the Viz Big editions of Dragon Ball or Dragon right. Z or Vagabond are more than the first 12 volumes.
Right. Yeah, I think those two might be the exception right now. I mean,
there's two types of Viz editions.
Yeah.
The 3-in-1s, which are basically lower quality paper stock. Cheaper, they're smaller, and then you've got the Viz Big editions. Viz Big editions are nicer paper right. quality, bigger, and so on. So whereas the Viz Big editions, I think, are meant for you know, libraries and to keep a classic title in print forever. The 3-in-1s, I think, are more meant to create an introductory and a painless introduction to a long-running series, like One Piece, like Kekkaichi, like Naruto.
Right.
Yeah, and I think they're very beneficial because you're buying 3 volumes for the price of 1.5. I mean, generally it's 15 for 3, where it would be if you were buying them as individual volumes, it would be 30. So,
it's great.
Yeah, I think it's great, and I'm glad to see early volumes of series stay in print because that has been a problem in the past. Where you get to volume 27 of Fullmetal Alchemist, you think it's an amazing series, you want to recommend it to your friends, and anything earlier than volume 15 is out of print or has such a low print run that it's virtually impossible to get a hold of. So, yeah, I mean, keep that stuff in print.
I think it's great. I mean, like even like the Death Note, they did the Black Edition, the reissues. I mean, it's a way of keeping a classic title relevant and available for a lower price, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all.
I have to wonder, because the first thing that comes to mind on this, it's like, if someone's claiming that it ruins it, are they doing the thing where they're bitching about the fact that it doesn't look right on their shelf because the spines aren't the same size? Because
whatever.
That is so common in hardcore collecting. My God. You look at any Blu-ray forums, holy shit, the arguments people get into.
I'll get a life.
All right. Darren Imenich asks, with the upcoming re-release of Sailor Moon, what other out-of-print manga would you like to see re-released?
I'll go through my list quick.
Well, Ed prepared for these.
Yeah, I know, I did. So, Adolf by Tezuka, Phoenix by Tezuka, Monster by Urasawa, and then I always get this name wrong, Nodame Cantabile.
Cantabile, yeah, whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
That one, Moyashiman, Planetese, and the final one is Even a Monkey Can Draw Manga.
I believe all that stuff's out of print.
Yeah, I know.
Huh, I mean, maybe Kodocha?
That's good.
Or perhaps Marmalade Boy is classic. Peach Girl. This is all shoujo stuff. Gosh, most of the ones that I really like are still in print, you know? Like Lone Wolf and Cub, you can get anytime. Akira, you can now get. It's been reprinted. Please Save My Earth, perhaps. I think that's an excellent series.
Basara is another one I hear people talk about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. You know, I've been on, like, this lifelong quest to find Basara Volume 19. You cannot find that goddamn thing.
Oh, man. A friend of mine has 2 of them.
What?
Yeah, I'll ask her if she...
Bastard!
I'll ask her if she wants to give one up. yeah, I found him in a book off, actually.
Like, you know, those Comic-Con, like, the swap meets, or I go to used bookstores, I go, Basara 19, ah, damn.
Yeah, man, it's tough to get.
That's the holy grail, but I like things like, even like the things I've been asking for, like Princess Nine, that's coming out this fall from Vertical. I would love to see Jungle Taitei, Jungle Emperor. But, you know, that's never been on English, so what am I talking about?
Yeah. Okay, Mark FBR, this is a little off topic, but he asks, what are your thoughts on the DC reboot? Ed, you're a comics reader, right?
Only Teen Titans, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, are you going to buy any of these? Because I have to admit, like, part of me is kind of like, yeah, I'll probably buy the number ones of, you know, Batman and Action Comics just to see what they're doing.
Yeah, I do actually get the previews catalog each month, and I just haven't really been impressed with anything DC does. And then, you know, they reboot, they do those mega events so often. It's just, I know that this is going to, like, last about a year. The editor-in-chief will change, and then the whole thing will go back to whatever it was before. And then the other thing being, you know, Action Comics has actually gone over 900 issues, and I can't see DC missing the chance when 1,000 comes up, not to celebrate like the 1,000th issue of Action Comics. So I kind of really skeptical that this is going to last. But
well, they're
it, I mean,
they're just trying to do what manga does, you know? I mean, manga has a logical beginning and end. What the problem with DC is, and you compared Marvel with DC, DC's characters were created in the 30s and 40s, and they've been trying to keep them relevant every decade ever since.
Yeah.
Whereas Marvel's characters were created in the 60s, and they've been trying to keep them relevant ever since. Whereas you look at manga, manga's created within the last 3-4 years, any given character. It's relevant. It's current. It is the product of one creator, one creative team. It has a beginning, middle, and end. With the exception of Koji Kame and maybe Bleach. But I'm just saying.
Well, the Shonen Jump series are designed to be endless.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But, you know, I'm just saying that it never needed to be reinvented. What they're trying to do, like, what DC Comics has painted themselves in the corner is the same way that the fine art world has painted themselves in a corner. That it's only relevant to people who have kept up with the movement that was a reaction to another movement that was a reaction to another movement, and you had to be aware of all these sub-genres and these sub-evolutions of this character. You know, when really Batman could have just been a simple story about a guy who lost his parents and became a vigilante. It never needed to be this complicated story about, you know, three different Robins who died and three different, you know.
The whole idea of that is you don't need to know all that stuff to pick up an issue of Batman. You really don't.
Like, you really shouldn't have to.
Well, yeah, you kind of don't, though.
So I get that, you know, the DC reboot was trying to start from scratch.
Right.
But, you know, but the fact is that they still are starting out with characters that were created in the 1940s.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you get gems like Morrison's All-Star Superman.
Yeah.
There are creators who get the characters, who know how to mine that history and say, okay, this is kind of the essence of the character, and this is the stuff that we really love about him, and this is the stuff we like to celebrate about the character. And that stuff generally, I think, for me at least, tends to work best in the miniseries, you know, about 12 volumes, letting people do that. I mean, that's what made, like, the Batman and the Superman animated shows really so good, is that the fact that, you know, they were letting guys like Paul Dini and Tim Bruce look at this, you know, 60-year history of a character and say, look, just take what works and then animate it. You know, don't worry about continuity. Don't worry about, you know, who slept with who and all that other crazy stuff that we throw in there. Just cut the character down to his essence and make it interesting and intriguing, and bam, that's what they did. I mean, that's why I tend to like the animated versions of the characters in the DC universe much better, is because they know how to cut them down to that essence.
Right. But, you know, I've argued a couple times that, like, if the Japanese manga industry was structured as the American comics industry, you would have creators like Masashi Kishimoto drawing Batman. Or you would have Masashi Kishimoto drawing, say, Dragon Ball. Or you would have, say, Taito Kubo drawing Astro Boy. What the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, come on. I mean, you shouldn't have the greatest minds of any given generation being tied to the iconography of a character that was created generations before.
I guess I kind of see your point.
Or basically, like, asking all the great bands of today covering Beatles songs over and over again.
Well, they do that, but yeah. No, I mean, I guess I would argue, my argument against that would be that the comics market is gigantic, and if you're only looking at superhero books, you're getting a handful of geniuses writing really good stories and a lot of chaff. But it's not like there aren't really great American comics. I mean, there's plenty of really good stuff. It's just not super mainstream.
No, there's a ton of great comics. I think Evan Dorkin made this wonderful point. He was like, if you're complaining about, you know, the lack of women in comics because there's a lack of women and females drawing superhero titles, I suggest that your perspective of comics is extremely limited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because there are tons of women cartoonists who are doing great work that has nothing to do with spandex and capes.
Yeah.
And to measure success or to measure integration as you drew a superhero comic,
I was going to SPX every year, because it is those independent creators, and it's people who are not only writing stories that aren't about superheroes, but there's always at least three or four people at SPX who are playing with form. The one guy who's I apologize, I can't remember his name, but like the guy who did the little Decision Maker comic, or he made a comic.
Jason Shiga?
Yeah. He did the To Die For comic, which is in the shape of a four-sided die from D&D, and it's about D&D in a romance. And so,
not Jason Shiga, but yeah, no, I get it.
Oh yeah, okay. No, I mean, but it's, you know, where he's playing with form as well as story, and then, you know, they're just, it's fun to go back and look and say, you know what, there is lots of innovation in comics. It's done by small independent publishers and producers who are just putting their own stuff out. Like there are a couple people at SPX, because I bought one of the comics where they, you know, they hand sew the binding on their comics. It's wonderful little neat stuff like that.
There's so, things like that in Japan. Like there's Comedia. Right. There's all kinds of, you know, independent, you know, characters, independent creators who are doing things that have nothing to do with characters, that have nothing to do with anime tie-ins or video game tie-ins. They just have this love of comics. I mean, going back to the DC 52 thing, I mean, I know DC had to make a bold choice. They had to know that they either were going down the, either going to like head down this path where everyone is trying to reinvent things or trying to make their pantheon of characters relevant. And they said, and it's too difficult with, you know, decades of backstory and universe and complicated relationships to deal with. So it's like, you know, let's just start from scratch. Let's just get down to the basics. So I applaud them for making this bold move. I'm being as a person who's read Crisis from Infinite Earths and the other reboots that DC has attempted over the years, I'm not spending a penny on this.
My curiosity just has to be sated. I have to see for myself what it's like. I'll pick up a couple of them. It won't be a big deal. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not like excited about it, but I'm very curious to see what it is they're doing. Okay. DeRhino asks, when will more publishers jump onto the digital bandwagon, and should they diversify what platforms they support more than just iOS?
I think all of them are, actually.
Right.
By now, I think all of them have made some claim to being on the digital platform. All of them are trying to... All of them, when you mention that, they will do the iOS first, and they're doing, you know, Android next. But one of the interesting things, I was talking with Kurt Hassler from Yen Press at Comic-Con, and I asked him, oh, so are you guys going to do Yen Plus, Yen Press titles on Kindle? And he goes, no, and here's why. Because I'm not satisfied with how the Kindle handles screen tones, because you get a moiré effect.
Yeah, it looks kind of shitty. Have you ever read anything on a like graphic novel on Kindle?
It's not great. It's not great.
Yeah,
so I mean, so he said it's not a matter that they don't want to. It's a matter that the platform is not prepared for it. It's not the optimum platform to read these titles in. And I had to respect that him for that, you know, because, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people in the comics industry were waiting for something like the iPad to really jump on board with digital publishing, honestly, because it provides an excellent way to showcase the artwork.
Right. And again, an install base that suggests you have the chance of making a little bit of money.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, now, I mean, if you've noticed in the last year, almost every, after years of, you know, half-assed efforts, almost all the publishers are online now doing mobile platform publishing.
Right. All right, Erica Friedman, you're a friend of mine, asks a question for Ed and Deb. What are the most positive changes you've seen in the manga industry in the past year?
I would say digital manga for one, and particularly Viz, Yen Press, and now J-Manga. I'm actually happy to see Seven Seas come back. You know, because they were kind of touch and go there for a while. It was, I mean, they technically never disappeared, but they got really quiet for a long time. So, and then the other one is, I'm actually, you know, we forget that Vertical and Dark Horse have seen a lot of growth in the past year. Those guys have been really bucking the trend as far as sales, and I'm happy to see that. I'm hoping that they'll continue, because I think both of them do very good at curating what titles they're going to put out and then really supporting what they do. So I'd like to see Viz and Yen Press do that a lot more too. It's be kind of more proactive with their marketing, and sorry to use the business terminology there, but to pump titles a lot more, particularly a lot of the smaller titles. It's easy to promote One Piece, but there's a lot of stuff in their catalog I think that needs to be promoted better, like the Signature and the Siga key lines.
I mean, I would agree that one of the most positive trends in the last year is the publisher's embrace of digital publishing. I think that's wonderful, because it not only provides more titles, and it provides a more attractive price point. It also opens it up to a lot more readers. Like, for example, there's a fair amount of iPad people who have iPads who are like looking for stuff to do, looking for things to read and
reasons to use it. Yeah,
reasons to use it. I mean, so you know, manga is there. That's awesome. The other thing I think is very positive is I think there's a lot more thought towards the quality of the titles versus quantity of titles. Admittedly, this means that you're not going to get every manga in the world out, you know, published. But I think the choices that are being made now are very thoughtful. I also noticed that there is more opportunities now, albeit still very small, for creators who are interested in the manga style to create original works. I think it's great that like Yen Press is allowing Rem, who won like a manga competition in Japan, to draw Solas. I think that's awesome. I think it's great that Viz Media is doing a lot of original content with their kids line. Admittedly, this is not what everyone would love to see, which is a lot more original content. But given that there are so many creators out there who are influenced by manga and creating them, you know, want to create comics, but are basically getting snubbed by the big two. Hello, DC. Hello, Marvel. have a chance to create and make and get paid for it. I think that's awesome. It's not where it should be. It's not where it could be. But, you know, the fact that it's heading in that direction, I think it's great. I always think about what Ellie Cookman said, you know, like the next Jack Kirby is going to be influenced by manga and she's going to be very successful at it. So we'll see where this is going.
I'm going to say positives. Vertical, which we've already talked about, doing very well. Good for them. Kudos. Nobody seems to be really in bad financial straits right now. Like, the remaining publishers all seem to be staying afloat okay. So that's good. Who knows, you know, once we see the final fallout from Borders. once we see the final fallout from that, things might get worse. But for right now, we seem to be in a bit of a holding pattern. You're not plummeting anymore, at least for the moment. So I think that's good. Yeah, other than that, I mean, welcome to 2008 for the manga industry. It's about where you're at in terms of where anime was, you know.
I think it's really helpful to remember that once upon a time, you could count the manga releases in one hand.
Yeah.
So the fact that we have the variety that we do now, it's not what it was, but you know, it's still something.
It's a changing industry.
Yes, it is.
All right. Vinny Av AGC asks, what's the best manga that's still obviously manga that you can use to introduce people to means from comic books? Okay, I think that makes sense.
Wait, can you say that again?
Yes, I'll say it again. He wants to know, what's the best manga that is still clearly a manga, has all the properties of a manga title, that you could introduce people who are used to comic books?
Actually, the first one I'll mention is Full Metal Alchemist, only because I got a comic book fan to read it, and then she became addicted to it. Mm. So that's proof that it works. Things like, I think, A Drifting Life or Disappearance Diary, those kind of autobiographical manga, I think are fairly good. I'm also a big fan of, like, particularly because these are single volumes, like Not Love But Delicious Food, All My Darling Daughters. And then because these are more sci-fi, I think they have a better chance, like Saturn Apartments or Twin Spica. Or ones I recommend. And Apollo Song I also recommend simply because I think it's the best single volume introduction to, like, Tezuka. It kind of, in one volume, kind of covers all his major themes as far as, like, love, technology, what it does it mean to be human, his Buddhism, and his view of nature. It's amazing. It covers, like, all that in one volume. So it's a good, like, do you want to know what he thinks and sample what he thinks? And then if you like that, you know, there's a bunch of other stuff to go read.
I say Cheese Sweet Home.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one, too.
Yeah.
Cheese Sweet Home is just so universally appealing. The art is very simple and straightforward. It is flipped, but you don't notice it. Hmm. Everyone can appreciate a story about a mischievous kitten that, as Chris Butcher was said, has dark undertones. I think it's a super appealing book. I mean, I've given it to people who loved it. What else would I give? Emma, I find really useful to give to people like Jane Austen books. Or conversely, A Bride's Story, which I think is just exquisite on so many levels by the same author. I've given, like, say, A Walking Man by Jiro Taniguchi, which is a very sweet... It's, oh, no, sweet's not a good word. It's a very beautifully drawn, very meditative book.
Mm-hmm. Although that...
Purely for the art.
Right, but, I mean, that one, I didn't recommend simply because he said, obviously, manga, and Taniguchi's art definitely doesn't look like manga. Because he's so influenced by Mobius.
I guess you could say that. I mean, it's just exquisitely drawn, you know.
It is.
I think you can appreciate it on those levels. Oishinpo, I've given to people who like food, just because I think it's fascinating. Let's see, Dorohedoro, but is just freaky science fiction. Is it 7 Billion Needles? It's very solid sci-fi. Yeah, I mean, admittedly, you know, when you're immersed in the manga world, you forget that there are certain manga tropes that if you threw it at anyone else, they'd go, what? Right. You know, they wouldn't get it. But there are some manga that is just universally wonderful, like Yotsuba is universally wonderful. I think Bunny Drop is universally very, very interesting. You know, like if they like horror, I think Lychee Light Club is just completely creepy and strange, but fascinating.
I don't know.
I wouldn't give someone Lychee Light Club. That will get them into manga. Are you nuts?
I wouldn't give it to just anyone. I'll preface. Right. But if someone likes horror,
yeah, sure. Well, that's the thing I was about to say. Like, it completely depends on the person you're talking to, and if you're smart, you ask them, oh, well, what are you into? What kind of movies do you like? What kind of books do you read? And you give them something that's similar, because there will be something that's similar to it. Like, the last person I got into manga, first I gave him Scott Pilgrim, which isn't manga, but I gave him Scott Pilgrim, and they're like, oh, this is cool. And then I gave him Gantz, and they were hooked. And now they're buying all kinds of shit. So,
you know. Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't want the gateway titles. I mean, everyone has said Ranma 1/2 is a gateway title.
Is it?
I don't know if it is anymore. I don't know what today's gateway title is.
I don't think so. That's why I think more something like Full Metal Alchemist is more of a gateway title.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Or Yotsuba, I think, is another good one, too.
Yeah. I mean, Pluto, of course, is wonderful.
Right.
Okay. Ether Future asks, with the Western manga industry small, with sales drifting, do you think there is potential for self-produced manga to grow?
Oh, that's a tough one.
I'm going to say, of course, there's room, but the odds that any of that will actually take off are like zero.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's tough. I mean, like, you look at, like, there's Gen Manga, for example, is a small manga publisher. There's Comic Loud. There's Bento Comics. There's a lot of people who are trying to make a mark in the digital manga space. And I think they're all good efforts, but will they ever outsell, say, even Kekkaishi? Probably not. I think it's good that, you know, the digital platform allows an ability to, it lowers the hurdle to getting your work seen. Because before, once upon a time, you had to publish, you had to print, you had to go to shows, you had to sell it, you had to schlep it, you had to mail it. No, you just have to have a website, you know?
Right. Yeah, I would say from, like, the webcomics would be, like, Mega Tokyo had success for a while. Sinfest is a good example of, like, manga influence. And then Nemu Nemu, which is another one I think does really well. So, I think you can do it, but you're probably going to have to go on some kind of webcomics model to build your audience. And it's a lot of work. I mean, you know, if you follow the creators of Nemu Nemu, you know that they're at shows, they're doing a lot of legwork to promote and sell their comics and their merchandise so that they can make a living out of it. It's, you know, it's not easy.
It definitely is not. I think the fact that you can do digital publishing has opened up a lot of opportunities for a lot of people, but it is not a matter of just putting up your comics on DeviantArt or creating your website and getting woohoo success, you know, money rolling in, offers rolling in. There are a few success stories, of course. You know, I mean, Nina Matsumoto was discovered because of her digital work, and Svetlana Chomakova was discovered because of her online work. But, you know, I know from walking around artist alleys and several comic cons all over the world that is just a drop in the bucket of the talent that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, like anything, you have to be able to be really devoted. You have to be able to pitch your product and sell it really hard. And you have to be really talented and funny and or clever and or a great writer. I think the barrier, one thing that the internet has done for comics is democratized success and made it to where the bar for entry is very high. Like, you have to be exceptionally funny. Exceptionally an incredibly skilled artist in order to find and I mean in terms of getting published, creating your, you can create your own little empire with a crappy webcomic all you like, provided you know put things in there that people are guaranteed to like and maybe buy your t-shirts or whatever. But in terms of getting recognized as a major talent, a major comics talent, getting published, entering into the life of a professional author, the barrier for entry is very high because you're competing against everyone.
Yeah.
You know?
I think, you know, digital publishing has created a lot of opportunities, but and there's a lot of people out there, but I think, you know, there's still a matter of luck, talent.
Yeah.
Right.
And being professional.
Yep.
Because I know a lot of great artists, a lot of people who are fantastic artists who can't tell a story.
Yeah.
Visually. Mm. Who can't. Who can't do things like deliver a transcript on time, you know, or can't do it without creating a lot of drama. So, I mean, it's being professional, it's being good, it's being lucky. You know, it's just not easy.
Yeah. All right. Chart Knight asks, do you think the American manga industry has bottomed out, or will sales continue to fall? That's a pretty bleak question. Ed, you want to take that one?
Well, unfortunately, with borders still kind of, you know, in its last demise, I'm going to have to say we're probably not at the absolute bottom yet, but I think we're getting fairly close. And what's interesting is when borders started announcing their financial problems, since I do get the previews catalog, was watching like Viz and Yen Press start to like increase their presence in that, you know, to try to kind of go back to the comic book store market. So I think there's still some dust to be settled, but we're, you know, like 90% there. So I don't think we're going to see anything much more significant. And it's just going to be companies readjusting, you know. Again, it'll be interesting to see how, like, Viz's new digital initiative works out for them. If the sales that they lost to Borders, they're going to pick up on the digital side. The same for, like, Yen Press and things like that.
Not anytime soon, I don't think. I think it's very hard to replace the income that they got from Borders. But, you know, it's I don't know if bottomed out's a good word for it. They're adjusting.
I think it's seeing a shrink, and, you know, it's not the end of the world. Things aren't going to totally collapse or anything. I don't think you're quite at the last of the bad news, but I think the holy shit catastrophe days are kind of waning, I think. Tokyo Pop closing was kind of the big, like, oh, shit, really? So there you go.
Yeah.
I think, anyway. I hope so. I hope that's the case. All right. Ether Future again asks, do you foresee any significant impact on the manga industry due to more publishers acknowledging light novels' potential as of late?
I think publishers are kind of veering away from light novels, honestly.
I mean, Yen Press is the only one who's had any success with light novels, and that's like Spice and Wolf, but then that had...
And I would say success with quotations among them.
Right. I mean, there was Spice and Wolf, but that had a really popular anime to kind of help boost it. And then there's the Haruhi novels, and that's just a kind of weird phenomenon in its own right.
I would even wonder, do those really sell?
It seems like there's a good fan base. It doesn't. I mean, it's not as like manic as it was, but it seems like there's a fairly steady hardcore fan base that's staying with that franchise.
I guess, you know, Yen, I guess what I'm saying is I think Yen's goal for that was to cross over to new readers.
Right.
Versus just the people who read the manga and watch the anime.
Right. And unfortunately,
these different covers.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen because, as been, I think, discussed before, a lot of those light novels end up in the manga section of your Barnes & Noble anyways. They wanted to get them over into the YA section,
right?
But have not really had a lot of success because they see Yen Press and they go, oh, that's a manga publisher. Put it in the manga section. They're not really, you know, they're not going to read Yen Press's marketing stuff, and they're not really going to care about what Yen Press wants. They're just going to say, look, if people are looking for Yen Press, it's easier if we just point them to manga than it is to say, well, do you want the light novel? I mean, like, they even care. Like, do you want the light novels? Do you want the manga? They're just like...
I don't even know if light novels are worthwhile for publishers to put out. I mean, I could be wrong, but it costs a lot more to translate.
Yeah, a lot. And, you know, like, Tokyo Pop tried for a while and didn't have a lot of success. It's interesting. I mean, now it depends on what they're saying is light novels. If they're saying that, like, this is sci-fi line, that's totally
not
different.
Those are not light novels. Those are prose.
Right. My only worry is that somebody might be thinking of them as light novels because they're coming out from Viz, but that would be a misunderstanding of that imprint because that's you know, hardcore sci-fi, and Viz is really...
But that's the difference. I don't see Heiko Soto novels shelved in the manga section.
Oh, right. No, I agree with you because I think Viz has done a really good job of making sure that imprint is marketed completely different and completely separate, and talking to like science fiction distri- I mean the people in the science fiction world who review those words, I mean, who review those kind of books, and they've done a really good, I think they, as far as that imprint, I think they've done a good job of connecting to like the general sci-fi reader. and getting the word out to them. Whereas, like, so if somebody's thinking that imprint is light novels, and that would be a bad impression. If you're going to think light novels, you really, the only thing you got right now would be Yen Press. I mean, because I think even the Full Metal Alchemist light novels never actually sold very well.
If you got to take yourself out of fandom for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask your mom, what's a light novel, would she know?
Well, no, but...
Okay, romance.
Would you, if you ask the average book buyer, would they understand what the term light novel means?
Well, aren't they really only calling it that for the fans who already know what it is, but putting it on the shelf, it's not like it says, this is a light novel.
No, I get it, but it's just that so much of its appeal is based upon your knowledge of a certain...
franchise, yeah.
Certain character, a certain story style. I don't know. I mean, I think marketing light novels... I don't know the book scan numbers. I don't subscribe to book scan because God knows that's a whole lot of money.
You don't have $20,000?
Oh, hell no. Hell to the no. I'm just saying, I don't know how well they're selling, but I don't think they're selling as well as people think they are.
I think it makes sense for blockbuster properties that, you know, the fans who want to own that stuff for the shows that they're obviously in love with enough to make successful. Like, that makes sense. Anything else? Nah, you're taking a risk. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. North Star Blog asks, any thoughts about the Takao Saito of GoGo 13 fame manga included on J Manga?
It looks really interesting. I haven't had a chance to, like, read through it. There's two I saw. One was Dingo, and then the other one was Devil King. And I looked at the preview pages, and what I saw was interesting enough that I'm going to go back and probably purchase those at some point. I think that's one of the things is if you like GoGo 13, then you're probably just going to read his other stuff anyway. So I don't think that's going to appeal to like any new fans. It didn't, at least what I saw, didn't seem to, that it was so radically different that you'd say, oh, no. If you hated GoGo 13, you'll like Dingo.
Well, I mean, I think what that's another example of what J-Manga's great for. Like, you know, Takao Saito is iconic. He's a great manga creator. But the fact that his most famous series is barely in print in America,
yeah,
it's a little sad. And I understand why. It's, you know, it's not for everybody. It's maybe geared mostly towards Japanese sensibilities and tastes. But, you know, the fact that, you know, now all of a sudden we've gone from one to, what, eight Takao Saito titles available to us because of J-Manga, I think that's great. You know, and the fact that no American publisher had to make a decision between, should I put out an old Takao Saito title or put out the latest, you know, hit shonen manga? Wonder what? You know? Well, I mean, it's simple now.
Right.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. all right. I have no opinion. I really don't. I'm sorry. We used to make fun of GoGo 13 that, you know, is something that would never sell, and it didn't really ever. So
I know, but somewhere out there, Carl Horn is very happy.
And Daryl Surratt, yeah.
Yes.
And that's got to count for something.
Hey, that counts for a lot, man.
Hell yeah.
I want Carl Horn to be happy for the rest of his life. All right. Ahava 22 asks, most anticipated fall manga title the average fan hasn't heard of.
People have heard of Drops of God, right? That's my personal favorite.
I think that's
average fan.
Obscure.
I would say probably hasn't heard of that.
Yeah,
oh, really?
I wouldn't say average fan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's my most anticipated title. I mean, obviously Sailor Moon is the title of the fall, but yeah. Drops of God is what I'm really looking forward to. I mean, it's a wine manga. It's about two young men competing to find the 12. Apostles, the 12 most amazing wines that this one very famous wine critic has put in his will. So it's very educational. It's very influential in the wine world. It's beautifully drawn. It's very dramatic. It's a lot of fun. I'm very much looking forward to reading it. I realize it's not for everyone, but I think it's wonderful that it's here.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with that one, too. It's interesting. Like, I loved Oishimbo. And I don't actually like Japanese cuisine. I don't like seafood, so... but I like reading food manga. It's really interesting to see what they do. And you learn a lot, even if I'm not going to particularly go sample the cuisine, so...
I mean, of course, No Longer Human, I think, is another one worth looking for. That's by Usumaru Furuya. It's he created Genkaku Picasso. He created Light Heat Light Club. He's a wonderful, really wonderful draftsman. And this story, I don't know much about the story, but it sounds like the equivalent of like Catcher in the Rye for Japanese literature. Yeah. Very iconic, very kind of dark, kind of speaks a lot about what it means about a disillusioned person and his descent into decadence. I can't really say too much about it because I haven't read it, and I haven't read the novel that influenced it, but from what I've heard, it sounds very intriguing.
Guys, side note here, sort of a tangent. Recently, I read Catcher in the Rye for the first time.
No!
Yep, first time. Never read it. Finally read it. And I gotta tell, boy, I wish I read that when I was 15, because as a 31-year-old, all I can do is sit there and go, God, what an asshole.
Exactly.
What a little shit. Shut up, you little shit. Why am I still reading this?
I suppose it's like reading Are You There, God? Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, when you're 40. Yeah,
for some reason.
Well, see, I did the same thing, because you hear about Catcher in the Rye all the time. So I think I was either 31 or 32 when I picked it up and saw it. I said, you know, I'm sick of people mentioning it, and I'm sick of hearing it in like all these movies and things that I like. And I had the exact same reaction you did, Zach. I was like, really? I was like, yeah, you know what? If I was 15 and conflicted about who I was, this might be brilliant, but man, this kid just needs to suck it up. Yeah. Come on, grow a pair.
Yeah, it's just like...
You know what that makes me realize? It's like, oh, is that why I don't get Neon Genesis Evangelion?
Oh, come on now. That's got some more universal themes, I think.
Okay. Because everyone talks about, like, oh, that guy, he should just suck it up. He's such a whiner.
Yeah, it's a little more identifiable because you're distant from that character. You're not inside his fucking head for however many pages, watching him just be this hateful shit. And it's like, oh, God. Anyway. Yeah. All right. Hazukari asks, which Tokyo Pop titles do you want to get license rescued? We kind of talked about this already. But are we just assuming everything they have is now needs to be license rescued? I guess if there's anything in that catalog you'd really want to see come back.
Planetese.
Right.
That's my big one. I think that has yet to be even, like, discussed among license rescuing.
I hear Planet he's talked about a lot, but honestly, I've never read it.
It's really good.
I saw the show. The show's good.
My personal favorite is Supply. But, you know, that's for very selfish reasons, because I think it's a beautifully drawn series that has... it's just... I just want to... I bought the rest of it in Japanese just because I wanted to know how it ended. I realize it's a very niche title. It's not something that every fan wants to read, but I think it's wonderfully done.
Cool. All right. Nothing comes to mind.
Or, you know, I would say, like, maybe Dead Man Wonderland should be rescued. I think that's a good series, too.
Yeah, that's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, the anime's coming out, so why not, you know?
God.
Right.
What lucky person's going to get Hitalia, huh?
Right. There you go.
Come on.
Just in terms of somebody making money, that's a good one.
Come on.
Yeah. Anyway, that about wraps it up. It's always great to have you guys on. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time. I'm sure we'll do a number 4.
Oh, all right, thanks.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Deb, Ed, Chris, and Justin for coming on this week. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can find them at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'd appreciate it if you left a review. That would be awesome. All right, thanks, guys. See you next week.